Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lincoln on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news relating to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here is your host of Lincoln on Lending, David Lincoln.
Hello, everyone. This is Alice Alvey filling in for Dave today. He is somewhere on a roller coaster in Orlando. So we wish him well as he's careening down roller coasters today. Now, I want to follow up and get everybody in on the program here. We do have today with us as special guest, Pete O'Connor, who is Senior VP of Public Policy and Industry Relations. He leads MBA's regulatory affairs and is joined MBA in 1996, and we are very happy to have his wealth of knowledge with us. And so we'll look forward to having Steve on our program in the future, in the next coming minutes here. But right now, let's go straight to Joe Farr and MBS Hotline. And I'm hearing the echo, Joe, but
yeah.
I apologize. Hopefully the listeners aren't hearing it too much.
Well, I hope not. Alice, it's a quiet morning today in the mortgage market. The MBS prices are up 1/32nd. They've been bouncing around between unchanged and up 2 or 3. So it's been relative to the prior days last week. It was it's been a very quiet week day today so far. But, and the Dow's up another 36 points. There was a little weakness out of Europe and China that had some, a little bit of influence, but not a lot. But last week, Alice, was a crazy week. Every week we lost a little bit in price. MBS prices fell over a point during the week last week. Much of it occurred on Friday as the jobs report came out. I'm sure by now everyone knows that the jobs report was way better than expected. 236,000 jobs announced when only 170 were expected. Unemployment rate fell from 7.9 to 7.7. And MBS prices fell half a point just on that news alone. For the week, again, every day the market hit lower prices as the Dow hit new highs. The Dow hit new high on Monday, and then I think it was each day last week, they hit a new high. Stock prices are rising is a good thing. As we all know, we all feel a little better about our 401ks, right? And then, and with home prices rising too, we're seeing good consumer sentiment, and quite frankly, it's all very good for the housing market. Higher prices, higher rates, certainly are a negative consequence, but it's still a very, very low rate relative to mortgage rates in the past, and with better consumer feelings about their pocketbook, about their nest egg, about their own home price, their home value, we're seeing an improving housing market. It'd be interesting to hear what Steve, if he has anything to say about the housing market, but this week, there is a pretty good amount of data coming out. The retail sales will come out on Wednesday. Consensus calls for a nice increase over January. CPI and PPI come out this week. PPI comes out on, when is it? It's on Thursday, and CPI comes out on Friday. Both are expected to show pretty large increases as it relates to the headline number. But that's largely related to the gas prices. You know, gas prices are way heavily on inflation. Without gas, though, both CPI and PPI are expected to be relatively tame. In addition to CPI and PPI and retail sales, we have industrial production and consumer sentiment come out on Friday. Treasury auctions Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday this week. Wednesday and Thursday are the 10-year and the 30-year, which we probably ought to pay pretty good attention to. The auction results will come out at 1 o'clock each day, and hopefully we'll see some favorable auctions. We'll see a little improvement in prices this week. So that's all from the mortgage market, Alice. I'll turn it back to you.
Well, thanks, Joe. I was very curious as to watching the market last week as there were so many things going on. I am concerned. I'm not sure if it's my phone that's causing the echo or not. So we're going to go to a commercial break, see if we can diagnose this, and we'll be right back with our legislative update.
Economic uncertainty has created a tremendous amount of market volatility for the past few weeks. Intraday price changes seem the rule rather than the exception. Have you been surprised by a midday price change? Have you been frustrated as you locked a loan just ahead of a price movement? Found it difficult to explain to a customer why the rate you quoted is no longer available? MBS Quoteline can eliminate these frustrations. MBS Quoteline monitors Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Ginny Mae mortgage-backed security prices in real time. It makes the information conveniently available on your desktop, smartphone, or by email or text message. These are the same prices used to set mortgage rates each morning and to issue midday price changes when significant movement occurs. With MBS Quoteline, you'll never be out of touch with the market,
whether you're in the office or on the road.
See for yourself what MBS Quoteline can do for you. Go to MBSQuoteline.com to start a risk-free two-week trial.
MBSQuoteline.com.
646-716-4972. The Lickin' on Lending Show is back. Here is your host, David Lickin.
Hello, Andy, are you there?
Oh, hello, everyone. This is Alice. I'm back. Sorry about that. So I do wonder if maybe the echo is coming from me. I'm going to go ahead and give my legislative update, and I'm going to try and see about dialing back in to get rid of that echo. But in the meantime, I want to give you a quick legislative update. We are watching House Bill 1078. It says that it's going to ensure that funds needed from the Treasury are only used to pay insurance claims that may be filed by FHA. As you know, it's been in the headlines that FHA, the Mutual Mortgage Insurance Fund, has a negative capital reserve, which I know we'll get some feedback from Steve on in our next segment. But we are going to hope that Congress doesn't try and get more involved in this than they already are. So we can see a House bill where they're trying to say, if Treasury's got to lend money, let's make sure it just goes to claims. As usual, we're going to still keep watching to see if there's any change in the CFPB director. We've got Senate Bill 205 to replace the director of the CFPB with a five-person commission. That went to committee late in January. No movement on that now, and we're still watching that. And, of course, if we can, see the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection repeal Dodd-Frank Act, right? House Bill 46. Not a chance it's going to go anywhere, but fun to know it's out there. That's going to be our legislative update for today. And Andy Schell, are you on the line? Andy, you may be muted. I'm going to ask that when this next commercial break comes off that we get you jumping on in there to jump in with your next segment right when we come back from a commercial break. Thanks
Looking
very much.
Looking for a full-service mortgage training and consulting company to fit exactly what you need? Mortgage U is your ultimate education and information resource used by lenders to execute high-impact, high-quality training throughout the organization. Mortgage U instructors are mortgage professionals
providing classroom and web-based delivery
and has the most sought-after training manuals in the country. Mortgage U has a proven track record performing customized training programs for hundreds and even thousands of employees both live and online on everything from application through loan delivery and insuring. Call Mortgage U today at 800-278-0200 or visit us online at mortgage-u.com. Welcome back to Lickin' on Lending. Our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here's David Lickin'.
All Shelby here again, and I'm just checking in. Hey, Shel, are you out there?
I'm on, Alice. Can you hear me?
Yes, now I can. All right, let's hear from the Prophet Doctor. What is the news of the day?
Well, first, though, just checking to see if the echo's there. Oh, yeah, the echo is bad still. Boy, all this technology, and we can't even talk. Sorry about that, folks. Unfortunately, we've got a technology problem that doesn't seem to want to resolve itself. I'll make my segment pretty quick, and we'll see if we can't get this resolved. Boy, this is really distracting. Sorry, everyone. Last fall, we talked about that mortgage banks were having a great year, and it was important to save our capital, preserve our capital, save our money for the future. And looking around Texas right now, it's springtime. It's springtime in Texas, and the squirrels are out running around, and those that were wise and saved their nuts have lots of nuts stored up and ready for another year. And I think the thing that we need to remember in mortgage banking is that for a lot of folks, we had a great year last year, and we expect to have a great year this year. But we need to remember, refi isn't here always. We need to build a purchase platform, be able to operate at a capacity level based on purchase volume, not just on refi. We need to save all the money we've made on the amazing year we had last year, use it for the future, save our capital, preserve our capital. We've got regulatory issues coming at us. We've got challenges in the future that are going to be cost drivers as we adapt to become the regulated entity that Congress is mandating through Dodd-Frank and all of the rest. So sounds like the echo dropped, so that's good news. I don't hear myself twice anymore. So the point is, as there was an article recently by one of the Federal Reserve governors talking about the commercial banks are going to have a 23 basis point drop in return on assets just because of new regulations coming down the pike based on all of the legislative actions that have happened. And for a mortgage bank going from little oversight to substantial oversight, the effect is going to be much more dramatic. So the point of all of this is, just because we had a great year last year doesn't mean we should go out and buy a new sailboat. We need to save our money. We need to preserve our capital because the future is bright. The purchase business is going to be strong for years to come. We had a great employment number. Joe was talking about it. Looks like real estate recovery. Kay Schiller showing good recovery. So things are happening. But be prepared for the audits. The CFPB audits are coming. Regulatory changes are coming. New disclosures are coming. Training costs money. Compliance people cost money. We were looking at a couple different organizations who have gone from having no compliance people to three or four. In one particular case, we had working with a mortgage bank owned by a commercial bank, and they've added five compliance people to the mortgage department. And if you assume an average salary is in the $50,000 to $80,000 a year, you know that's $200,000 to $300,000 in salaries just for compliance issues. So we've got to save our money. We've got to watch our margins. We've got to manage our margins. We've got to manage to the bottom line. We've got to know how much our profit per loan is by branch, by region, by originator, so that we can have the right margin in there to cover the costs that we're going to be addressing in the future. So, Alice, whoever
yep.
did whatever they did to make the echo go away, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Yes, thank you. I can think now.
I know. It's so distracting trying to think when I hear myself twice. But thank you for fixing it. And back to you.
Well, thanks, Andy. You know, it's interesting that you bring up that point about the overhead. You know, do you find your companies are the companies that you're working with? Because I know we're seeing a little bit of it. You say I've got over $200,000 in salaries now, but at the same time, is that still less than the potential fines and penalties? And so it's necessary because it's like an insurance policy.
Oh, exactly right, Alice. I mean, the fines and penalties could be terminal. I mean, it could be you're dead, you're done. You get your license, you get your state license pulled. I mean, messing with the regulatory compliance issues is a game you don't want to play. Messing with regulatory compliance in the commercial banking world puts people in jail. So just don't go there. Yes, it's going to cost more. Yes, it's a seller's market for compliance people. Everybody needs more. So that's just the reality of the business we're in today. But accept it, adjust your margins accordingly. The sad part about all of this and all of these efforts to protect the consumer more is that the consumers are going to be paying a lot more for their mortgages than they have in the past, because that's what's going to happen. It's going to pass through to the margins. The margins are going to end up with higher prices, and it's affecting everybody. So everybody's going to have to increase their spreads and save up the money and get ready to deal with the regulatory changes that are coming.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I know we'll get a chance to talk about this more as we talk with Steve about what we can expect, because so many things hit everybody at the end of January here. So we do need to make sure that we'll get a chance to talk more about that. Because I know as I'm sitting with my customers today, I've got a room of about 60 loan originators today. And, you know, you walk that fine line, or should I just focus on selling today? But I am impacted by all this. I feel it in underwriting. You know, I feel all the operational changes that now start to mean a loan is taking longer to close. And it takes us a while to adjust through every step of the way. So we got all our new compliance last year. We saw capacity rates for processing and underwriting drop. Well, now we seem to be getting a better control, better handle on that as we put some systems in place. And I think we're really having to gear up to prepare for some of that. Again, another swing in capacity changes for how many loans a processor can handle, how much can an underwriter handle. And that's, again, where the compliance departments come in, I think. Folks have to gear up in other areas to try and take some of the burden off of the front-end staff. And it's a balancing act.
Exactly. Well, we're working with one client. We're working with one client who has, you know, talking about turn times and compliance, dealing with compliance and turn times at the same time, which are, you know, counter-cyclical kind of effects. So well, what's happening is that files are coming into the organization, and before they even get anywhere, before they get to underwriting, they're sent into compliance. And compliance taking a day or two, sometimes three, to look at everything. So the point being, instead of making it go faster, you've made it go slower. So it's 2 or 3 days in compliance before it even gets to 2 days or 3 days in underwriting before it even gets to. So it's an interesting dilemma, but it's facing everybody, and everybody has to adapt to it.
Right. Well, and then you look at some of the regulations wanting to even add more time, you know, more waiting periods with the HUD one, potentially needing that the customer has to have the HUD one 3 days ahead of closing. That's a challenge, you know. So it looks like we just have to prepare our customers. But at the same time, I think there's so many technology solutions that are arising, which we can talk about on future shows, and people have to figure out how to not let compliance hold up the whole system, though. I mean, I can't things move down two paths at one time, right? I don't have to have the compliance area holding up the file. That's a balancing act always.
Exactly.
All right, well,
exactly.
Yeah. Now, we can talk a lot about a lot more about this as we get into finding out from Steve O'Connor, Senior Vice President of Public Policy and Industry Relations at the Mortgage Bankers Association, and we get some more information from him. What I've been being told from my producer is we're going to stay away from playing the commercials and using the blog talk system because it may be where the echo is coming from. So we're going to just be rolling into our next segments here. So, Steve O'Connor, do we have you on the line?
You do. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Steve. Welcome to the broadcast. Well, I'd like to know a little bit more about, in your view, what is the number one issue from the Mortgage Bankers Association as members? You know, I love the feedback and information we get from MBA, and to me it seems like there's a lot of moving parts. So is there such a thing, I guess, as putting one thing top on the list right now?
You know, it's difficult to do. There are so many public policy issues we're trying to contend with right now. But if I would say there's one thing, it's trying to help our industry navigate the new rules that are coming out and that have come out and that will be coming out later this year. We're calling 2013 the year of regulatory implementation. Mm-hmm. We saw over 3,000 pages of rules cumulatively come out in January, mostly from CFPB. And these are rules that are implementing various provisions of Dodd-Frank. And you know, these are major rulemakings, game changers in effect, the ability to repay qualified mortgage rule, the national servicing standards, the loan originator compensation qualification rules, And then we've got a number of other rules in the queue. So at MBA, what we're trying to do is help our members in the industry get ready to what they need to do to be able to comply with the rules, most of which will go into effect in January of next year.
Well, and I think that's the challenge. You know, as I talk to folks, they go, well, is it okay to start with my planning for implementation? I mean, let's start. Can we start with QM? You know, can we start with a qualified mortgage and say, is this set enough in stone that I can now start taking a look at my business model, and am I going to only be what I call the green zone? My way of describing this to people when you have to teach it is there's the green zone of QM, I'm in a safe harbor. Then there's the yellow zone, the caution zone of where I actually stepped into, I have a high-priced mortgage loan, and now I don't quite have the safe harbor. I'm in the rebuttable presumption of compliance zone, or I'm all the way into red zone and I don't have a QM loan. And frankly, I could have repurchases that end up in the red zone. And I've got to balance my business. So is it too early to start walking through that? And what do you recommend people do?
Yeah, so a couple things. I mean, you know, first of all, there was the 800-page rule that came out in January. But there is a concurrent proposal that they also published, and comments were just due February 25th. So the actual rule is not completely settled because there will be some additional guidance coming from CFPB in the near term. Until we get that and know how they resolve certain issues, particularly around the 3% points and fee test for a qualified mortgage and how they're going to treat loan originator compensation, until we have those details, we're limited in what we can actually do. But MBA has put a lot of information out. One of the things we've done is we've created a new web resource called Compliance Essentials. And if you go on the MBA, Campus MBA website that's part of MBA's domain, and you'll see right in the middle of it, there's a big green banner called Compliance Essentials. And we're going to be hosting various webinars to help the industry understand how to comply with these rules. In fact, our first webinar is going to be held next Monday, the 18th of March from 2 to 3:30. And it's entitled How to Build a Compliance Program. And we're going to have some outside attorneys and some MBA staff on the line to walk people through kind of the fundamentals of a compliance program, whether it's for QM, servicing, LO comp, any of the rules out there. So I think the first thing to do is develop kind of the basic core foundation. And people have those now, but they're going to have to ramp them up. It was interesting to hear what Andy was saying about all the compliance officers and personnel that are being hired right now. And that is where most of the employment growth is taking place in the industry, because people are having to ramp up to get ready to comply with the new rules.
Well, and that's the thing. I think a lot of folks are looking at, let me get my shop in order first with what I know exists today. Let me at least focus on that. We see companies going to get a CFPB readiness test. Lenders in particular are diving more into fair lending than they ever did and trying to at least get that all squared away right now as they wait to, as you said, see the responses on the pieces that were pending on QM. So I have a question about that. So basically it was the points and fees test that had a comment period open until February 25th. Do you have any insight for us on how that's going to work, how we're going to include loan originator compensation in the points and fees test?
You know, I think it's too early to say. We just filed our comments, and we're going to be meeting with CFPB in the coming weeks. I can tell you what our concerns are. We think the test, as drafted, was overly inclusive, and in two particular areas. They in effect, double count LO comp and over count. And then they also, we think, disadvantage lender affiliates' third-party charges. We think those need to be treated the same as independent third-party charges. There's no reason to discriminate against lender affiliates. So those were our two primary concerns, and hopefully those will be addressed. I'm more optimistic on the LO comp front than I am on the lender affiliates.
Hey, okay. Steve, this is Joe. On that LO comp deal, when you say you double candidates, I'm glad to hear someone say that, because I've been very confused as to an origination fee obviously should be counted, but then how do you also count LO comp? So are you thinking that it will just include the origination fee and whatever you pay the loan originator is irrelevant?
Right. We think exactly that the fees that are paid by either the lender or the brokerage to the individual loan officer or individual broker will not be counted a second time, only the fees to the brokerage or the creditor. And so that's a that's very much a positive in terms of reducing the impact on that 3% cap.
Well, that's huge.
And I should add on that point, the consumer advocates, when they filed their comment letter, were actually in agreement with us on that particular point.
I love that. I love when we can agree.
Well, that begs the question of what are the brokers saying? I know that the brokers have taken the position that the full amount of their fee is included, whereas in the mortgage bankers area, it's not. Any thoughts on how any of that might work out? I know you don't represent the brokers, but how about that difference?
Well, we're sensitive to the impact on the wholesale broker channel. We don't think there should be discrimination against different business models. At the end of the day, the consumer is paying the same amount. And so you shouldn't disadvantage the wholesale broker channel. And that was part of our comment letter that we filed.
Okay, that works out great. Andy, do you have any questions for Steve?
Well, in listening to this, I do have a comment to make, and that's that I'm really, really glad that the MBA has stepped in and is addressing these issues and has someone like Steve available to help represent the industry, because obviously Steve's very experienced and very knowledgeable, and everybody wants to look at his bio. He's a very, very capable mortgage banker, and having this kind of legislative or lobbying or response to federal activity representing mortgage banking available to the industry, I think, is just exceptional, because these issues are complicated. And even if you get your head around the issues, I think the real challenge is explaining it in a way to the staff and the representatives and the agencies in a way that they understand. You know, we're not just trying to protect the industry. We are, but we also are trying to protect the consumer. We're all on the same page about doing the right thing, and getting them to understand that is much, much more challenging than it may seem. I used to do lobbying years ago, and trying to get the legislators understanding can be a challenge, because they don't necessarily know the industry, they don't understand the nuances, they don't understand the dynamics, and being able to both understand it and communicate in a way that gets them understanding, I think is just it's very, very difficult, and I'm just delighted that the MBA is spearheading this effort and has someone like Steve on board to make it happen. So that was my observation so far in listening.
Well, Steve, so what else is on the list?
The shorter term, it's what do we need to do to comply with the rules between now and January of next year. Longer term, obviously there are concerns around FHA. It's been under considerable financial stress due to its countercyclical role in the marketplace. And, we testified recently. Dave Stevens, our president and CEO, was up on Capitol Hill. There'll be a lot more hearings on FHA because of the concerns over its financial position, and what reforms can potentially be implemented to make it more financially sound, at the same time allowing it to continue to fulfill its core mission, which is to help first-time homebuyers, low and moderate income, and underserved communities. So FHA is going to be very important in the coming term. And then the longer-term issue of what to do about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac has been getting more focus recently due to the bipartisan policy councils recommendations, which just came out a couple of weeks ago. And it's a group of commissioners that have very impressive pedigrees in terms of their background, both politically and in terms of industry knowledge. And their recommendations have kind of rekindled and jump-started the debate again about what to do about Freddie and Fannie. So, bigger picture issues about how do you restructure the secondary mortgage market and how do you right-size the government's role in the marketplace. Those are going to continue to be issues throughout 2013.
Hey, Steve, along those lines, has that bipartisan committee come up with recommendations that differs too terribly much from what MBA has proposed in the past?
I would say on the core principles, we're very much aligned, which is that the government needs to play a role in providing an explicit guarantee for certain types of mortgage-backed securities. Absent that, you won't be able to get the sort of investor confidence you need to maintain liquidity, particularly during a financial crisis. Where we might have some differences are on some of the operational nuances. I mean, one of the challenges with any plan or proposal at this point is how detailed are you going to try to get? And MBA, when it came out with its proposal in 2009, went to what we thought was an appropriate level of detail at that time. The Bipartisan Policy Center went a little deeper in terms of detail, but again, they left some blank spaces on the canvas. And so any sort of plan, the trick's going to be, and how do you try to operationalize it? How do you actually capitalize the institutions? How do you protect the taxpayers? What sorts of rates are ultimately going to be available for borrowers? And just the basic mechanics of any securitization operation that would be funded and set up and established.
Now,
so I think
there's
basic alignment on the principles.
Okay. Now, did I hear that there is a group, so this bipartisan council, now, is there actually a group that's starting to be formed? And can you explain what makes up this bipartisan council? Is there more to it than that, than just an advisory group? Or are there people actually starting to try and work out all the details of the function? It can explain the role of the bipartisan council.
So the Bipartisan Policy Council is an independent entity, and they put together a housing commission. And it had some, you know, well-established political veterans, such as former HUD Secretary and Senator Mel Martinez, George Mitchell, the former senator from Maine, Kit Bond, the former senator from Missouri, Henry Cisneros, the former HUD Secretary, and then a whole plethora of industry and consumer experts and advocates, including Rob Couch, MBA's former chairman. And they met for well over a year to try to develop a plan to restructure the secondary mortgage market. And just a few weeks ago, they put their proposal out. And I think what it's done is renewed interest in terms of a number of stakeholders at looking in terms of what sort of alignment is potentially possible given the time and effort that this group put into this. And then the open question will be, to what extent does BPC try to engage in some sort of advocacy to advance their plan? But we, you know, the first hurdle was getting the plan out there.
Now, so this group, is this group going to continue to meet, or this was it, they published their report, and we'll look at next steps once we get to some further analysis?
I think in the near term, they're going to continue to conduct outreach to educate stakeholders and others as to the particulars of their plan. Longer term, I'm not sure what they intend to do, but in the coming months, I believe they intend to continue their outreach efforts.
So is it fair to think that this is actually getting some real momentum long-term going forward for a change? I mean, can we expect to see this continually advancing?
I think what it's done is it's gotten stakeholders to begin talking again about where there may be common ground. And that's going to be one of the keys. If you can get alignment among industry groups, consumer groups, and other key members of the debate, you have a much greater likelihood of actually making progress. I mean, this is a difficult issue, both in terms of the substance and the policy. It's very complex. And then the politics around it are very tricky. So if you can get stakeholders to begin to align, that gives the issue much greater momentum.
Well, I know Go ahead. Go ahead, Joe.
I was going to ask if the actions that Ed DeMarco just announced are they consistent with what came out in this bipartisan group?
So what Acting Director DeMarco announced is a little different in that he put together a new scorecard for the 2013 scorecard for the FHFA strategic plan for Freddie and Fannie. And part of what he announced was that they're going to be forming a new entity that's going to be initially funded and owned by Freddie and Fannie, but separate from the two GSEs, and this new entity is going to basically be the entity that develops a single securitization platform, which potentially becomes a replacement for Freddie and Fannie. I see it as different but potentially complementary to other efforts to reform the secondary mortgage market. So it's distinct from the BPC or the MBA plan, but it's one more element in the debate.
Right.
Well, how about FHA? Let's talk a little bit about where we see FHA going. You know, the reports have come out with the Mutual Mortgage Insurance Fund being in trouble, depending on how you want to look at it, right? And I know that Dave Stevens mentioned in his testimony, I believe he said, you know, that, and some of the other folks as well have been saying, FHA isn't in need of an immediate bailout, assuming the economy stays, you know, on its path that it's on right now. So what's MBA's, what's your view on this? What should we be worried of with FHA? Are they going to be making, you know, people on our call worry about underwriting changes, right? What goes an MIP increases? What else do we have to look forward to on top of what we already know is happening April 1st?
Right. So, yeah, FHA is under a lot of stress right now, and it has been for a number of years as it's played a critical countercyclical role in the marketplace, and its capital reserve ratios, you know, it's actually negative, and it's in the hole to the tune of about $16 billion. But a lot of that's based on modeling and assumptions, and there are a number of variables that could work in its favor over the next year or conversely work against it. We think it's prudent to begin to, first of all, implement some reforms now, which, as you mentioned, FHA has already started, and then longer term to begin to have the debate around what needs to be done to right-size FHA, because arguably it's got too large a footprint in the marketplace, and how do you protect the Mutual Mortgage Insurance Fund while still fulfilling FHA's core mission. You know, FHA plays a particularly important role with first-time home buyers, lower-income home buyers, and minorities. And you need some entity to continue to play that role. We believe FHA can be a key part of what takes place in that space. But it's important to begin to look at critical reforms. And some of the reforms that are going to be debated are going to be things such as, you know, should there be a higher minimum down payment? Should there be some sort of minimum FICO score? What about loan limits? Should they be targeted in a different way? So there are going to be a whole lot of issues that are going to be put forward in the coming months as Congress and other others in the policy arena begin to debate what to do about FHA.
Well, so when we talk about the changes, at least the ones that were in the testimony were related to much lower credit scores that most lenders aren't even taking today. You know, so when you talk about saying, well, I need 10% down. If their credit score is going to be 580, everybody goes, okay, well, that's great. That won't bother me. But does that really change the fund then, since we've got investors essentially have set a minimum credit score way above where FHA does? And, you know, we can clearly see FHA's average credit score increasing. You know, you don't see anything then, it sounds like, beyond what Mr. Stevens said in his testimony and in ways of any potential underwriting changes in the future?
I think there's a possibility you'll see other changes either because FHA will initiate them or Congress will mandate them. And so part of what we're doing at the MBA is consulting with our members as to, you know, the trade-offs in any of these different policy options. And at the end of the day, that's what you have to look at. So if you go with, for instance, a higher down payment, well, that's going to hurt a lot of first-time home buyers because that's the biggest barrier to home ownership, right? It's the accumulated wealth for the down payment. If you go with some sort of risk-based pricing, more discrete risk-based pricing regime, that may better protect the Mutual Mortgage Insurance Fund, but it could adversely affect certain key segments of the population that you're trying to reach. And so what we've been doing with our members in the various policy groups that we have is looking at these trade-offs. And first of all, kind of defining the trade-offs, and then the next step will be to decide which recommendations we want to make that are consistent, again, with the goals of preserving FHA's core mission and also protecting the insurance fund.
Well, and I do. What about the seller contribution? FHA did at one point had out there that they were going to be changing the seller contribution limit and reducing that down to 3 or even 4%. I think from the FHA subcommittee, we talked about that. What do you see? Do you see that we can rest easy that that is put back, tucked away in a corner somewhere, and not to come back out?
I think for now, but that's, you know, the sort of issue that could come back around. As well as, you know, sources of funds. I mean, FHA allows gift funds from certain sources, and so those sorts of issues will be debated again as they look at ways to potentially tighten the program to protect it.
Tighten the program, yeah. Joe, do you have any questions for Steve?
Yeah, I'd like to switch over to QRM. That's the
yep.
next big one that's out there, and I know people are working on it now. I know MBA's got to be heavily involved in that. So where do we stand on QRM, and when do we think we'll hear something?
Sure. So QRM is the exemption from risk retention from the joint rulemaking by six regulators. And Chairman Bernanke from the Federal Reserve is testifying recently before the Senate Banking Committee, and he talked about efforts by the regulators to try to get that rule out later this year. One of the things that MBA has been arguing, in fact, we held an event on Capitol Hill this morning with some other industry groups and consumer groups talking about the need to harmonize the qualified residential mortgage exemption from risk retention, the QRM, to harmonize that or synchronize that with the qualified mortgage standard under the ability to repay. And by statute, the QRM can't be larger than the QM, but there's nothing that says it can't be defined the same way. And so we said, look, for operational simplicity and for getting credit flowing and to getting private money back into the market, you want to harmonize QRM and QM. And we've gotten core alignment with a broad coalition of partners, both from the consumer advocates arena and from the industry. And that was the purpose of the educational briefing we were doing on the Hill today, is to show that there is this alignment and begin to educate policymakers, at least on Capitol Hill, as to the need to synchronize QRM and QM, and the next step will be to continue to do the outreach to the regulators who are going to be putting pen to paper as they try to finalize that rule this year.
So by saying that, you would say if the loan falls within the safe harbor of QM, it should not have, if it's securitized, it should not require risk retention.
Yes. In fact, I'd even go further, not just within the safe harbor of QM, but within the rebuttable presumption as well.
Okay. Good. Good.
So, we believe that the QRM exemption should be fairly broad. If you think about it, I mean, you're excluding, I mean, what doesn't fall inside the QM or the QRM under that construct are the risky products that were part of the housing bust several years ago. I mean, so, interest-only, NEG-AM, option arms, those things are not eligible for the qualified mortgage treatment, and they therefore wouldn't be eligible for the risk retention exemption under QRM. And so you're really saying that QM and QRM should be confined to fully documented loans, more traditional products, with safer guidelines, and we think that's entirely appropriate, and that's the pitch we're going to be making with the regulators in the coming months.
Well, and it's the government that's setting the underwriting requirements on most of those loans, given it's FHA, VA, Fannie, and Freddie.
Right. I mean, so in today's marketplace, 90% of the market's either GSE or government, and that's just too large. And unfortunately, QM and QRM, the way they're drafted, probably won't in the short term change that. But if you create a rational regulatory regime, then private capital, with more regulatory certainty, then private capital can begin to figure a way to get back in.
Well, I guess we've got to wait and see the final rule. I think it sounds promising what you're describing, though. I think, like you said, to hopefully put people's mind at ease as to we will be able to get the, a lot of QM in the green zone and the yellow zone, as I keep saying. May not need to have the risk retention. Andy, anything for Steve before we take a quick break here?
No, it's great discussion. No, but nothing pops into my mind at this point, though, Alice. Thanks.
Okay. We'll go ahead and get a brief break here, and we'll be right back after this word from our sponsors.
Mortgage Banking Solutions is the preeminent management consulting firm to the residential mortgage lending industry. No other firm in the U.S. offers the menu of services or the level of expertise to the industry.
If you're looking for help converting from best efforts to hedging, or need help with bookkeeping to know your profit per loan,
if you are interested in making the transition from broker to banker, or if you just need a roadmap for success,
Mortgage Banking Solutions' primary focus is to enable executives to take their business to the next level and guide them down a path towards success and profitability. With over 300
combined years of experience in all facets of mortgage lending, the Mortgage Banking Solutions team of professionals has the expertise and know-how to help you accomplish your goals. New warehouse lines of credit,
broker-to-banker transitions,
transitioning to hedging,
financial and accounting services,
or meeting your capitalization needs.
If you need help with these or any other aspects of your business, please contact a Mortgage Banking Solutions sales team to see how we can help you at 512-977-9900. That's 512-977-9900. Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level.
In today's climate, quality counts more than ever, and Wetzel's Trot can help your company maintain the quality that you require to survive in an ever-changing market. With over 450 customers across the country, Wetzel's Trot has specialized in quality control reviews for residential lenders since 1985. Wetzel's Trot can assist your organization in maintaining a high standard of quality within your residential mortgage operation. They offer a wide variety of services, including loan quality control, servicing quality control, quality control plans, fraud review services, and even web-based quality control software. Quality is never an accident. It is always the result of high intention, sincere effort, intelligent direction, and skillful execution. Choosing Wetzel's Trot represents the wise choice of many alternatives. Contact Wetzel's Trot today for details at 248-592-2252. Wetzel's Trot, the single source solution for your quality control needs.
And now, broadcasting live from Austin, Texas, we're back with the Lickin' on Lending Show.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Alice Alvey hosting today as Dave is out with his family. As our special guest today, we have Steve O'Connor. He is Senior Vice President of Public Policy and Industry Relations at the Mortgage Bankers Association. He leads the MBA Regulatory Affairs Mission. He has been with the MBA since 1996. Previously with that, he was with the National Association of Realtors, Freddie Mac, Skyline Financial. He really is a great resource for us at the MBA. So, Steve, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for, we've got so much information. FISA, FHA, QM, QRM, what else should our members and listeners be paying attention to right now?
Well, there, you know, a couple rules are going to be coming out later this year. One is the RESPA TILA disclosure integration rule. And mm-hmm. if nothing else, it's going to cost people to change their forms, their disclosure mechanics, train their staff, change their systems. So that's going to be a big rulemaking from that perspective.
Not that much. I'll change everything I'm doing. I get it. Okay.
Yeah, right. So on top of all the other change we've been talking about, so it's a big deal. And then you've got Basel III capital standards. That rule is going to be finalized sometime this year, according to Chairman Bernanke's testimony recently, and that's going to have a big impact, particularly on mortgage servicing rights and how they're treated. And then there was a fair lending disparate impact rule that came out in early February that I don't think is on a lot of people's radar screens, but basically, and that goes into effect in early March, it basically says, look, if you're engaging in certain business practices, and while you may not be intentionally engaging in discriminatory treatment, if the effect of those practices is discriminatory, you could potentially be held liable. And that's of considerable concern because of the juxtaposition with all the rules that I was mentioning earlier, the QM and such. So as a lender, if you're trying to be very cautious and stay inside the four corners of the rules, you could potentially, if your practices hurt certain population segments, protected classes, you could be liable under the disparate impact rule, in effect be caught in a catch-22. So that's something that has us very much concerned. So there, you know, a number of rulemakings that are out, some more that are coming, and the question will be how do these different rulemakings interact with each other? Because as you know, the mortgage system is a complex kind of ecosystem. And changes in one area can affect lots of others.
Well, can we go? Well, can we talk about each one of them? So RESPA TILA, you know, I actually just finished talking about that and showing people what the new disclosures are looking like, and I'm amazed as to how many people have no idea that this change is even happening. But you know, it's my understanding that people are moving forward as if these forms are fairly much in their final stage. But if I recall, there were a lot of loose ends on. Will our tolerances change, and are we going to have an APR change or not? What are your thoughts on how many
interesting parts are still out there with Respectiva.
So I think the most controversial is the notion of an all-in APR. And it's my understanding that I wouldn't say that that's not on the table, but I would say that it's one of those areas where industry and consumer groups are largely aligned, that that wouldn't be a good change at this point, given all the other changes. And if you think about how important that APR is, it affects the qualified mortgage safe harbor test because of the APR trigger in the safe harbor test versus
right.
the rebuttable presumption. It affects HOPA loans. It affects higher-priced loans. So now's not the time, we think, to make changes to an all-in APR, and I think there's a fair amount of alignment with the consumer group, so hopefully CFPB has heard that. The issue of tighter tolerances, particularly the zero tolerance to third-party affiliates, where the lender requires you to go with the lender choice. I mean, those sorts of things, I'm not sure where CFPB is on that right now. I think what happened was CFPB was, they had to pivot toward the end of last year and early this year to try to get all these other rules out, the LO comp, the QM, the servicing rules, and a couple of others. My guess is now they're beginning to refocus on Respectiva.
Okay. Well, it is, it would be nice if we said we could just focus on the forms, right? Let's get that
yeah.
down with the existing rules that we have and we know today and not try and change up APR and add a transaction coverage rate and all that other good stuff. You got to go, wait a minute, can we even get the forms down first? So the big question a lot of people have is this three-day waiting period before closing where a customer's supposed to get that combo HUD, truth in lending disclosure 3 days ahead
right.
of closing. What are your thoughts on that? Do you have a crystal ball for us on that one?
To go back to what you said a moment ago, Alice, that's the exact position of the MBA. If you want to change the forms and combine those and get the integrated disclosures, that's fine. It's all the mechanics around the requirements that we're wary of changing at this point. Too many moving parts right now, given all the other changes in the system. And so hopefully, CFPB will recognize that. I mean, if you're a regulator and you're looking at what the challenges are in the marketplace right now, credit is too tight. And why is it too tight? I think it's too tight for two reasons. Lenders are having to reallocate resources to compliance. And then lenders, by and large, have had their appetite dampened for innovation and responsible risk-taking because they're concerned about legal and regulatory liability. And so the regulators are moving forward in constructing the appropriate guardrails for safe products and sound underwriting have to be paying attention to the fact that if they overcorrect, to use a term, that they run the risk of tightening credit even further. And so I'm hoping that they're sensitive to these concerns, particularly when they look at things like Basel III and Respectiva.
Well, Joe, that's your area of expertise. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, actually, I've been trying to formulate questions about the legislative thing. Can we switch
sure.
over to that?
Whatever you like, absolutely.
All right. Well, Steve, I guess the next big event from a legislative perspective is whether or not we're going to get continuing resolution in the funding of the government beyond when the 27th of this month.
Right.
And then included in that might be the question that we read about occasionally, and that's whether or not the home mortgage interest deduction is at risk. So could you touch base on what the MBA is thinking about those things?
Yeah, so, we're very concerned about threats to the mortgage interest deduction. If there are changes, you want to make sure that they're rational and that they're phased in over time so it's not disruptive to the market. But I think the MID, the mortgage interest deduction, is always going to be an inviting target for reform. It has been in the past and will continue in the future. In the near term, I think it's going to be safe during the debates around the continuing resolution. First of all, I think both parties and the Congress and the White House want to resolve the CR and put it behind them and get permanent funding through the rest of the fiscal year. The Republicans, in the last effort, where they avoided the sequestration and they kicked it down the road before it actually went into effect, agreed to a number of, in effect, tax increases is the way they would look at it. And they have drawn the line and said, you know, we are not going to agree to any more tax increases. And in their minds, changes to the mortgage interest deduction would fall into the category of a tax increase. And so I think that if they hold to that, and I think they will, House Republicans in particular, then I think it's going to be unlikely that you'll see any changes to the mortgage interest deduction this year. I do think, though, as you look at the challenges around the U.S. debt and ways to engage in meaningful reform on the tax front and with entitlements, the MID is going to continue to come up again and again and again. And so to the extent that there are changes made at some point, it's going to be very, very important that they're rational and that they're phased in.
And, Steve, there have been a lot of scary situations proposed or anticipated because of the sequester and the reduction in costs. Are any of those on the MBA's radar? Like, is FHA experiencing, or are they going to have to experience a across the board cut? Might that impact the timeliness of their ability to help process loans?
Yeah. So as I understand it from the couple of conversations I've had and people I've talked to who have been talking to other people, that there are furloughs in a number of agencies, including FHAs. They have to reduce their operating costs, but that it hasn't had any material impact on the processing of endorsements or claims. And longer term, I think they're going to resolve this before there's any real material impact to day-to-day FHA operations.
Good.
Andy, do you have any questions for Steve? We've got a couple minutes left here in the broadcast. We've got about 3 minutes left.
Well, I think it's always interesting to talk about the home mortgage interest deduction and the that I can remember that being talked about 30 years ago, and it never is. So I kind of a two-part question. One is what really is the probability to the extent that it's even possible to assess that the home mortgage interest deduction really would get addressed?
Well, if you look at who's against changes, you've got some very powerful housing groups that oppose any changes to the mortgage interest deduction, including the National Association of Realtors and the National Association of Home Builders. And the MBA has been part of that group in certainly arguing against changes that would destabilize the housing sector. And at this point in time, we believe and changes to the MID would fall in that category. On the other hand, there are a number of low-income housing advocates who have argued that the mortgage interest deduction is not a very effective subsidy. It disproportionately favors upper-middle-income and upper-income borrowers, and that it should be converted to a credit that would help particularly families that currently don't itemize under the current tax code, and that by changing the deduction to a credit, you would help more borrowers, you would save money, and you could take some of that money and devote it to helping lower-income families in the rental multifamily space. So that's the political tension on the other side. And in between, you've got the U.S. government trying to find ways to decrease costs and increase revenue to deal with the broader fiscal environment. And so I think that means the MID is going to always be one of those things that's going to continue to come up as part of the debate.
Yes. Well, and the effect of the deduction for those who have current refinances in the threes and fours versus when rates were 6, 7, 8, it's half the effect because the amount of the deduction is substantially less because the rates are lower. And what's interesting about that is that people who are unable to refinance but own a property and unable to because of either can't get through to HARP or because property value issues or FICO issues or on and on and on. So those people are paying higher and we would be disadvantaged by not being able to deduct it. So they're not able to refinance because of financial distress of some sort, because otherwise they would have to get from a 6 down to a 3. So it's an interesting debate, but with rates as low as they are, the effect of the deduction becomes less significant and so I wonder if you think that would have an impact on people's acceptance to the fact that, oh, do I hear the drums already? Oh, sorry,
yeah,
I'll step to you.
Yeah, that's all right. Got a quick answer. That's okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, there's less of a cost savings by changing it right now. I mean, the big issue is going to be should it stay at $1 million? Should it still be available for second homes? you know, maybe eliminate the second home, maybe lower the cap from $1 million down to something lower. Those are the types of changes that I think are most likely if they make them.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Steve, for being on the show today. We appreciate all of your insight, and thank you, everyone, for listening today. We look forward to having Dave back next week and hearing all about his day riding roller coasters. So have a great week, everyone. Take care.
Thank you, Alice.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This has been Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lickin of Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. Today's guests were Joe Farr from MBS Quoteline, Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions, and Alice Alvey, President CMB of Mortgage U. Come by next week, and thank you for listening.